Matthew chapter 5, we're talking about Matthew writing to the Jews primarily. He's letting them know about their king. They're looking for a king, but they sure didn't want it to be Jesus. They didn't want him to be the kind of man that Jesus was and do the kind of things that Jesus did and say the kind of things that Jesus said. They were shocked to find out that this man Jesus was claiming to be the Messiah. Matthew, a Jew, writing to Jews about a Jew named Jesus. We've covered several things. He's dealing with we're dealing with the Sermon on the Mount here. Verse 13, Jesus speaks to his disciples especially. Now remember, the Sermon on the Mount, he's speaking to quote-unquote disciples, those that were following him, which means some of them were lost and some of them were saved. And that's why we'll find in these two or three chapters that there's some things that's addressed to the lost and some addressed to the saved. Here he's talking to those saved disciples. He likens them to salt, verse 13. Ye are the salt of the earth, but if the salt have lost its savor, wherewith it shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing, but to be cast out and to be trodden underfoot of men. Some have actually used this verse to say you can lose your salvation. Well, he's not talking about salvation. He's talking about testimony. He's talking about influence. He likens us to salt. Why in the world would he use salt as an illustration of his people? Well, there's several different reasons. There's some things that salt, only salt can do. There's some things that salt can do that nothing else can do. And that's true of us believers. I mentioned, and you know, salt seasons. It adds spice to life. Some foods, I know it's not good for you, but some things just don't taste good without salt. There's some things I can do without salt mostly and not be bothered too much. But there's some things I want salt or don't want them. This popcorn that you pop and salt just falls off, I just throw it away. I don't want it. Salt seasons, it adds taste. There's some things that just are no good without salt. And Jesus is saying that life without Jesus is dull and uninteresting and boring. So it means this, that life with Jesus should be the opposite. It should be exciting and thrilling. Salt seasons, it adds spice. The Christian life is not, at least should not be boring. We should realize the greatness and the wonder and the delight of the Christian life every time we get up, every morning, every day. To be honest, the only way to have real fun in this world is to be saved. Salt adds spice. It enhances flavor. It makes something that's bland tastes good. And that's how we as Christians should be. We should make the world a better place. You put salt on some things, it's just better. That's just it, pure and simple. And we as Christians should make the world a better place. We should not be grim and depressed. I understand the burdens of life. I understand the tears of the Christian. And so does the Lord. But in general, we ought to be a happy people, a joyful people. We ought to add spice to this world. I will say this, I believe it. If anybody in the world should have joy, it should be us that are saved. Jesus said, ye are the salt of the earth. What's he mean? We ought to add spice. It ought to be, the world ought to be better because you're in it. Salt not only seasons, but it preserves. Now, that's important in our day to an extent, country ham, that type of thing. But in Jesus' day, it was vitally important. They did not have refrigeration. They did not have the ice makers and the refrigerators and freezers that we do. So to preserve, especially meats, salt was vitally important. And that's one reason why Jesus said, ye are the salt of the earth. As Christians, we are preservatives. Just like they depended on salt to preserve their meat, it kept the food from spoiling. We're in a world that is putrefied and is spoiling. And the salt that's introduced into this world and literally preserves it. Remember what God said to Abraham, if you can find 10 people in Sodom, 10 righteous people, I'll spare it. Unfortunately, he couldn't find that many, and those cities were judged. But those Christians sprinkled throughout the country preserve our country, our world, is spoiling, it is rottening, and we are to be that factor in the world that preserves it. Literally, it means that God will spare. I believe that's one reason why our country has been spared thus far with worse judgment. I see it coming. We are experiencing it already. But salt preserves. It keeps things from going bad. Salt also heals. It is not the easiest way to heal, but it heals. You've ever had a cut and found some salt water, maybe put your foot into some salt water, had a sore throat and you gargle salt water. Salt has a healing aspect. This world is like an open wound. The sin of the world is like an open wound, and salt can heal that wound. It can get in and attack the infection and heal the sore. So we as God's people ought to have that healing aspect. The message of the gospel can heal whatever problem this world has. You've listened to all this stuff about the presidential candidates and all that's been going on in this world and all the terrorism and everything that's involved and the economics. This whole world's just coming unglued. But there's not a problem in this world that the gospel won't fix. We are the salt of the world. It has that healing aspect. Salt also stings. If you ever tried to treat a sore with salt, you'll find that to be so. It stings, but it has the healing aspect. You apply salt to an open sore, and you'll know something's going on. Well, the gospel message that we have. I'm talking about Jesus said, ye are the salt of the earth. Well, what does that mean? It means our message sometimes stinks. When we tell people the gospel, which also includes you're a sinner, and you'll go to hell if you don't get saved, that kind of message stings. Nobody likes to hear, you're a sinner and deserve to go to hell. That message stings, but also, as I've already suggested, it sure does heal in hell. Now, we are the salt of the earth, said Jesus. We should not be surprised when there are negative reactions to us, our testimony, our message, our witness. When people frown or make fun or reject or resist, shouldn't surprise us. It stings them to hear what we say so many times. But Jesus doesn't just say you're the salt of the earth. He continues by saying, if the salt have lost his savor, literally means the saltiness. Well, what good is salt if it's not salty? I'll tell you what Jesus said, it's good for nothing. And a Christian that has lost his saltiness, a Christian that's lost that aspect of healing and helping, a Christian who never witnesses and that stinging is never a part of their life, even though people don't accept it well, it's still needed. When salt has lost its savor, when it's no longer salty, it's no good whatsoever. It is literally worthless. Jesus said it's good for nothing. And what they did then is took the salt when it lost its saltiness and they would throw it through the streets. That would aid in their traffic and their travel because it would build up the street. But it was useless. It was worthless. And Jesus said it right there, cast out and to be trodden under foot of men. He said when salt's lost its saltiness, it's no good. They cast it out on the street and people come by and horses come by and wagons come by and they trot it down and they walk all over it. And the picture is our testimony. When we have lost our saltiness, when there's nothing different about us, when when we no longer have that aspect of us that shows that we're different, our testimony is no good. And literally, it not only is no good, it can be harmful. It not only can hinder the work of Christ, it can harm. Big difference between hindering and harming. How many times have you heard, if that person's a Christian, I don't want to be saved? Well, that is someone walking on their testimony. They have lost their saltiness. And that's what Jesus said. They're worthless. They're no good. We are the salt of the earth. But then Jesus also likens us, his disciples, to light in verse 14. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. One thing's for certain, Jesus would say it, and he did, and we would say it, and we should. Our world is in darkness. There's a spiritual darkness that has hovered over our world. Our world is steeped in spiritual darkness. And the way to overcome darkness is by turning on the light. And Jesus said, ye are the light of the earth. You are the light of the world. Now, when he came into the world, he said, I am the light of the world. But now he's saying, you, my disciples, you are my light. I'm getting ready to go back home. I'm getting ready to go back to the Father. And when I leave, you will become the light that I have been. You are the light of the world that spreads light through the whole world. It's a sad thing that men love darkness. They love darkness better than the light. Well, why? Because light reveals themselves. Light reveals their sin. Light reveals who they are. Light reveals their condition. And nobody wants to face that. Nobody wants to face what they are. Lost world stays lost because they want to stay lost. And we are lights that have been placed in this world to give light to a lost and dark world. We're the light that shows forth the Lord. We are the light that shows forth the darkness. Our life is to display the light. Our life is to display the light of God in our hearts. It literally is, if you will, if you are filled with light, all you do is open your mouth and open your eyes and it bursts out. Oh, that's the picture here. The light's inside. And it's displayed and demonstrated by how we live and what we say and how we act in this world. Jesus said, a city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Well, even at my house, I'm not on a hill and Thomasville's not on a hill, but I can see the lights at night. But especially when it's really dark. I mean, they didn't have lights like we do. Lights and candles in a total dark world. Boy, a city on a hill would really be visible. And Jesus said, in essence, that's the kind of light you're to be. The world's dark. The world's bad. But light makes a difference. And that's what we're supposed to be. We're to be the light of the world. We're to make our dark world a little bit brighter. Look at verse 15. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Jesus said, you don't light a candle and put it under a bushel basket. You don't hide the light that is contrary to what the lighting candle is for. You light the candle and you put it up on a candlestick and it broadcasts the light, where as much darkness as possible is dispelled. Jesus said, that's what I've done with you. You think you're at that rotten job because you can't find anything better, or because you just got a run of bad luck, or you think you're in that neighborhood, or you think that person at work, or that boss man, or that friend, or that family member, or you think you're stuck there. And it's just bad, bad, bad. Well, it may be bad, bad, bad. But God has put the light in the place of darkness. He's put you on a candlestick. He's put me on a candlestick. I've worked at some pretty bad places upholstering. And I did not like them all. But I tried to remember every time I went in, I'm supposed to be a light. There are times that we are in the place of darkness and it is dark and we don't like being there. But we're to be light. He said, you are the light of the world, and you put lights up on candlesticks to where they can be seen and they can do the job and they can make a difference in the world. Their darkness can be dispelled. So I'll just say it like this. Just shine wherever God puts you. Let your light shine throughout the darkness. And that's exactly what he said in verse 16. Let your light so shine among men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Let your light so shine among men that they may see your good works. That tells me what my light is. My light is the works I do. The light that he speaks of is our good and our godly works. That they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Some will see your light and they'll want that light. They'll see your godly and your good works. They'll see the light that's in you. And it says that they'll glorify your Father which is in heaven. There'll be some who will say, I want what you've got. And they will believe the message and receive the light you have. And then they become lights. And it's all to the glory of the Father. They see God in us. That light in us. They see. And what is it? Our good and godly works. When we're patient when most people wouldn't be patient, and kind when most people wouldn't be kind, and right when most people would rather do wrong, and godly works, that's what they see. That is the light they see through us. And he says it makes a difference. Verse 18, for verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Jesus is here talking about his relationship with the Old Testament. Remember, Matthew's writing to Jews. Jews are Old Testament people. That's all they've known, rightfully so. They have been raised in the Old Testament. They have been taught in the Old Testament, rightly so. So, if he's the king, one thing they're going to want to know is, what does this king think about our Bible? What does this king think about the Old Testament, the law and the prophets? We do know this, the law and the prophets, the Old Testament, came from God. And if this king is of God, we want to know, what does he think about the Old Testament? And he's showing them here. He says that, I have come not to do away. I should have read verse 17. Let me read that. Think not that I am come to destroy the law of the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Miss that. Jesus said, if you want to know what your king, if you want to know what I think about the Old Testament, I'll tell you what I think. Not one jot, not one tittle. We'll be rearranged. It'll not be revised. He said, I didn't come to do away with the law. I didn't come to destroy it. I came to fulfill it. Here's what Jesus is saying. All that law that you rightly believe to be from God, every bit of it's been pointing to me. I did not come to change it or revise it. I did not come to say, okay, Old Testament, bye-bye. Oh, no, no. He said, I came to fulfill it. It's pointing to me, and here I am. He said, I think not I've come to destroy the law of the prophets. I came not to destroy, but to fulfill. And then he says, it'll never pass away. Till heaven and earth pass away. Not one jot or one tittle of the jot is the smallest letter in the Hebrew language, alphabet. It would be kind of likened to our I, small, lowercase I, a line and a dot. The smallest, he said, not even the smallest letter I will not take one letter from this law. But he didn't go there. He didn't stop there till heaven and earth, one jot or one tittle. A tittle is literally a little mark. I almost put it in your notes and notice there's two letters in the Hebrew and really in the Greek also that are so close. You can't even hardly tell the difference. There's just one little eh, and that little eh is a tittle. It's kind of like that I and the dot. That dot is likened to a tittle. In other words, Jesus said, I won't even take one letter out of the law. I won't even take one dot out of the law. He said, I didn't come to change it, do away with it, rearrange it, tell you you've mistaken and believe in the law. He says, I came not to do away with it, but I came to fulfill it. He said, not even the smallest little dot will pass away from this book. I'm so glad. Now, he's speaking the Old Testament, the law and the prophets, Moses and the prophets. But we can say that about the whole Bible. It's a perfect book. It's an up-to-date book. Do you understand that this Bible you have, a lot of it is thousands. In fact, I've got to say this, all of it is thousands of years old. And I can get up in the morning and read it just like yesterday's newspaper. It's up to date. That's amazing. You know what that is, don't you? That's a miracle. And Jesus said, I did not come to change it, rearrange it, not to tell you to do away with it. He said, I came to fulfill it. So we don't have to worry or wonder. We can rest assured that we can believe what it says. I can live my life by it. I can raise my family by it. I can preach from this pulpit by it. And I can die by this Bible. It is God's Word. God says there's going to be consequences for those who believe it and obey it. Look in verse 19. I sure am not going anywhere fast tonight. Whosoever therefore shall break one of the least commandments, these least commandments, and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. He said, whosoever shall break one of the least of the commandments. Now the scribes and the Pharisees, the religious people, the people who were supposed to tell everybody what the law says and what God says in the Bible, they said, now there's some real big commandments, and boy, they're important. And then there's some smaller commandments, and they're important too, but they're not near as important as the big ones. They said there's some great ones, and then there's some small ones. That's what they taught. But Jesus said, if you break what you would think to be the least, he says, you've broken the law. Jesus is saying, there are no great ones and little ones. There are no big ones and little ones. He said, they're all great. If you break even what you would think to be the smallest, you've still broken my law. The reason they're all great is because they all come from God. And that makes them all great. That makes them all important. And he said, if you break even the least of the commandments and you teach others to do, here's, I guess, a good way to illustrate it. Adam and Eve, all they did was take one bite of fruit. That's all they did. Sure seems awful little, but it wasn't. And Achan, all he did was take a few things from a lot of things just one time and had them. It seems like it's awful little, but it wasn't. And Jonah, all he did was say, no, God, I don't want to go preach that one revival. I'd rather not go, and tried to run, but it seems awful insignificant to us. But Jesus said, even what you think is the least is important. And he says, and teach others, teach men so. It's the nature of mankind. Just doing wrong myself isn't enough. I got to get somebody else doing wrong too. Someone doing wrong, someone sinning by themselves It's just not good enough. They got to get somebody else in on their sin. And Jesus said, if you break the least of the commandments and you teach somebody else to do it, you'll be the least in the kingdom of heaven. Notice, you can sin and still be in the kingdom, by the way. But here's what he's saying. If you want to know what's great, the disciples, even you know yourself, they're always fussing about who's going to be the greatest. Who's going to be the greatest? Peter or Paul, or Matthew or James, or who's going to be the greatest? Jesus said, if you want to know what person will be the greatest, it'll be the person who keeps even the least of the law, and the least of my commandments, and the person who teaches others to do the same. He measures greatness not by personality or by dynamics or intellectualism, but by doing His will, doing His commandments, doing what He says. He said, if you want to be great now in the kingdom of heaven, and later on when the millennium comes, you Jews, do what I tell you to do and teach others to do the same. Jesus speaks in these following verses about righteousness. Verse 20, look at it. For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no wise enter into the kingdom of heaven. Amen. I can hear the gasp when he said that. I can see the eyes darting around to each other. I can see the question mark in their eyes. Because as far as they were concerned, the scribes and the Pharisees, and especially the scribes and Pharisees, had this opinion of themselves. They thought, man, we are fixed. The scribes and the Pharisees literally follow the law to the letter. I mean, if anybody was dedicated to the law, the scribes and Pharisees were. Now, it was only outward. It was not inward. We may look at that later. But they still outwardly appeared righteous. Outwardly, they did what the Bible, the law, said to do. But Jesus says, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you won't even enter the kingdom of heaven. Man, you talk about throwing cold water on them. If my righteousness has to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, and to be honest, they're as close to the law of anybody alive, who's going to make it? How can that happen? And he clarifies in the next few verses, because he's trying to get them to see and us to see. It's not just outward. Scribes and Pharisees, they had that down. They had the outward. They had the external, the do's, the don'ts, that the people could see. They had that down pat. But Jesus said there's more to it than what you can see. There's more to it than the outward. See, He's concerned with our heart. He's concerned with the inside. He wants obedience, but He wants it from the heart. You who have children or grandchildren, which would you rather? I'll do it, but I don't want to. I'm sitting down on the outside, but I'm standing on the inside. That rebellious obedience, but rebellious. Or had you rather have them gladly and willfully and submissively obeying what you ask? Well, that's what Jesus is saying about the world. That's what He's saying about the religious world. Outwardly obeying is obeying, but that's not what I'm asking for. I'm asking for a right heart. Doing the Word of God is important, but doing it for the right reason is more important. We need to realize just how important these things are. Look on in verse 22. I don't know whether to start this or not. I want to go ahead and try and peck on this. These verses used to drive me crazy. I think I've gotten a hold of it to some extent. I hope that I have. I'll share with you what I'm thinking. Verse 22, but I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause, now he's already dealt with that. Let me turn to it real quick. I want to make sure I don't miss this. I may never get to that one. Verse 21. Ye have heard, I'm talking about, Jesus said, it's important to do right. And the scribes and the Pharisees do right, but they're not right. And he's saying, and look at verse 21, ye have heard that it was said of them of old time, thou shalt not kill. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. I may not get past that this evening. Verse 20 and verse 21, I want to get this real quick, but I want to get it. For I say to you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no wise enter into the kingdom of heaven. Ye have heard that. Those two have to go together. Ye have heard. Tells us something. He is speaking to Jews who have heard what their teachers have taught them, scribes, Pharisees, rabbis. And Jesus, and here's why I want to back up and get this. Jesus is not saying that the law is wrong, but they are saying how they interpreted the law was wrong. Ye have heard. They had misinterpreted what God said. It's not so clear in verse 21, but it will be later. Jesus is not saying, I do not agree with the Bible, but he is saying, I don't agree with how you've interpreted the Bible. You say, but I say. You hear that? Read it. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of judgment. But I say unto you, he's saying, you've heard it, but you've heard it wrong. Better said like this, you haven't heard the whole story. Now, you've heard that it's wrong to kill. No doubt. That's written in Exodus. Thou shall not kill. But it continues, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. He's saying, God not only said, don't do it, but he said, if you do it, you'll pay for it. Now that's what the law said. They had mingled it up, messed it up. But then he continues, but I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Now get the picture. Jesus said in verse 21, you have heard, but I am saying, verse 22. Verse 21, now get this and I'll quit. I want to get this tonight. Verse 21, kill somebody, pay. And that's pretty much what the Bible said, Exodus. But Jesus said, I'm interested in more than just whether you literally kill somebody. I'm interested in why did you kill somebody. Now don't get ahead of me. He is not saying like the judge, the liberal judge that says, oh, this poor little fellow was raised in a hard home and sure he killed 10 people, but we got to feel sorry for him. That's not what he's saying about. He's saying about this. He is saying, listen, it's not just what you do, but it's what's in your heart. Verse 21 deals with the act of murder. Somebody kills. Verse 22 deals with the heart. Listen, and the anger that caused somebody to commit murder. Jesus said, you've heard all your life, don't kill, don't kill, don't kill. If you do, you'll pay. But he says, I want to tell you something more. It's not just the actual act of murder, but it's the anger in the heart that caused somebody to murder. And in this verse, he deals with 3 degrees of anger. Notice it. Whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause, number one, is in danger of the judgment. Whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, number two. And whosoever shall say, thou fool, number three. 3 degrees of anger. Now, I want you to get this. Take a minute. We'll be done. Jesus said, sometimes you'll get angry with your brother. You really don't have a good reason. He said, that anger inside needs to be dealt with. And he says, if you're angry with a brother without a cause, shall be in danger of the judgment. The judgment there is like a local court. Every city of any significant size had a local court. And it was literally like this, getting a ticket and having to go to court for it. That's kind of like what it would be to apply to our lives. So the first degree of anger, Jesus said, if you're angry with your brother without a cause, number one, it's wrong, but number two, if you don't deal with it, it'll cause you to do something to where one of these days you'll be in trouble with the law. That's literally what he's saying. He's saying doing it is wrong, but not stopping it makes matters worse. I may pick on this a little bit later on too, but I want you to just sort of, we'll just lay a foundation. Then the second degree of anger. First is a person who's angry with his brother without a cause. No, he'd say not real bad. And he said, a person who's angry with a brother, if they don't deal with it, sooner or later they'll have to do something. Maybe they'll go and flatten that fellow's tires. And they'll get caught and be arrested, have to go to court. That's the first degree. The second degree of anger. His brother without a cause shall be in danger of judgment. Here's the second. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. So here's the second degree of anger. Raca is a word that is abrupt. It has the idea of anger. It has the idea of real anger. It has the idea of calling somebody a dummy. It has the idea of being more than just a little angry, a little bit irritated. The first one is somebody just sort of irritated. Second one, can I say like this? They're more irritated. And Jesus said the brother that called, the one that calls his brother Raca will be in danger of the judgment, excuse me, the council. The council was more than just the regular court. This was the Sanhedrin. It's like our Supreme Court. So it's like this. The first degree, somebody kind of irritated. He goes and flattens a fellow's tires because of the anger inside, and he gets caught and has to go to court. Second one, somebody more irritated, more angry. Instead of just flattening his tires, he burns down his house. We got a federal offense here. We got a major problem, and instead of just going to the little community court, he goes to the Supreme Court, it will say. He's got a bigger problem. And it's all because of the anger inside. It's all because of what was inside. Then he goes on even further in the third degree of anger. Whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Each one of these degrees of anger, if they're not dealt with, will lead to something that causes trouble. First fella flattened the fella's tires, he goes to court. Second fella burns the fella's house down, he goes to the big court. But here's somebody who says, thou fool. Used to boggle me, and I hope maybe you won't get it tonight. I don't know. I hope you do. And Jesus is literally saying, thou fool means empty-headed. It's a term that it would only be used on very rare occasions. It has the idea of significance. It has the idea of real anger. It has the idea of vengeance. It has the idea of just overwhelming anger. And Jesus' point is this. Anybody who has that kind of anger, they're not saved. And anybody who has that kind of anger and doesn't deal with it is in danger of hellfire. So let me wrap it up. Verse 21, Jesus said, you have heard. You commit murder, you'll pay for it. Cut and dry. But Jesus said, there's more to this thing than just did you do it. I'm interested in why you did it. I'm interested in the anger that caused you to do harm. I'm concerned, I say unto thee, I'm concerned about why. And he gives three examples. One, a person who says to his anger with his brother without a cause, he said, this person will end up at the judgment. Secondly, a person who says, Raca, he's in danger of the council, the higher court. Then the person who says, thou fool, he's the one that's in danger of hellfire. Do you get it? First person's a little irritated at a brother. He takes that irritation out, that anger out, by going and flattening his tires. He gets caught and he pays for it. Here's another fellow. He's more angry. He goes and burns the fellow's house down. He gets caught and he really pays for it. But here's a person. His anger's different. His anger, thou fool, empty-headed, vile. Jesus said that kind of anger is only in the heart of a lost person. And that person, if he doesn't deal with his anger, if he doesn't deal with his sin, will one day go to hell. Jesus' point is this. It's more than just, did you do it? But he's saying that anger inside needs to be dealt with. And if it's not, it's going to lead to things that are worse. I may pick on that again. I don't know. If you didn't get it, let me know, because I don't have time to deal with it anymore this evening. Well, let's just stand together. There's no stopping place. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being patient.